The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Rochelle Saunders. Today's show is all about autonomous robots and how they're being used in research to expand our knowledge and capabilities. Later on in the show, we'll talk to Stephen Waslander, assistant professor of mechanical and mechatronics engineering at the University of Waterloo, about his team's entry into NASA's Sample Return Robot Challenge. But first, let's find out how autonomous robots that evolve can maybe help us understand our own evolutionary journey better. Today, we're speaking with Dr. John Long, director of the Interdisciplinary Robotics Research Laboratory and chair of the Department of Biology at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York. He's a professor of biology and cognitive science, and his research ranges from the evolution of robots and fish to the biomechanics and physiology of locomotion in animals. Today, he's here to discuss his book, Darwin's Devices: What Evolving Robots Can Teach Us About the History of Life and the Future of Technology. John, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Rochelle.
So I'm going to start in the same place that your book starts, actually, which is, what do robots have to do with biology?
Yeah, it's really weird, isn't it? I get a lot of strange looks from biologists when I say I'm working on robots, and they say, well, you're not a biologist. You're supposed to work on fish or dolphins or whatever you're interested in. And the answer to the question of what do they have to do with robots have to do with biology is that if we build them the right way, they can be great models of organisms for us. And so it's a way to test our understanding, kind of putting on an engineering hat. You know, if you can build something and it works, that means that you understand how the real living thing also operates. So we're constantly using robots as models to test our understanding of the animals. And that's sort of the biological paradox.
What's interesting here is you're not even just talking about testing your hypothesis or understanding of animals living today. You're also using robots to model how animals or organisms may have been ages and ages ago, ones that are extinct.
Yeah, and this is what I love, because for years, I would go crazy wanting to figure out about the origin of vertebrates. That's the group of animals to which we belong. They're animals with backbones. And the very first vertebrates were alive over 500 million years ago. And so there are some really cool fossils. But the problem is, dead fossils tell no tales, right? There's no behavior there. You just have the bones. And so you have to try to reconstruct what happened. I kind of like to think of it as if we could do a new episode or a new series of CSI and call it CSI Evolution. And what we do is we'd reconstruct the evolutionary crime scene, use the physical evidence that's available to us. And what we would do is build robots that were meant to be those animals 500 million years ago and let those robots behave in the crime scene, which is the ocean, which is where these first fishes were actually evolving.
Now, you turn to robots. You've decided to turn to robots in your research. But I know that both in your history and for some other biologists, they're actually turning more towards computer models. What's the sort of difference between the two, and when might you pick one over the other?
I find that I can make everybody angry at me. I get the biologists upset when I say, hey, we can study biology using robots. And then I get the computer scientists upset when I say, you know what? Physically embodied robots, robots that are there in the tank, are actually better models of swimming fish than what we can do on the computer. And I don't mean to get people upset, but it's just a way of getting at the fact that everything you do in terms of a different kind of model, be it a computer model or a robotic model, has pros and cons, plus and minuses. And so to your question, when is a computer model a good model? Computer models are great if you need to run hundreds and thousands of generations of artificial evolution. They're not as good as our robotic models, though, in terms of actually getting the physics behind the propulsion. The great thing about physically embodied robots is you get the physics for free. You don't have to model it. And what's really tough, if you've played video games or you've seen seen movies is where they do a lot of animation is getting the physics of swimming right. So we actually use both robotic models and computer models in our research to try to handshake and work together to either get very rapid evolutionary trials with the computers or very physically accurate trials with our robots.
What other benefits might there be from choosing to use a robot? I know one of the examples you gave was that you can either sort of shrink or enlarge certain parts, depending on what you're looking for or trying to test.
This really gets to, Rochelle, the whole reason you model. You know, a really good model in science allows you to simplify the world so that you can understand it. And yet in that model, you've captured something really essential about the world. And so scientists don't want to admit it, but modeling is kind of an art form in the sense that you're dealing with all this complexity as artists do, and you're making decisions about it. Your decisions are informed by your intuition as a scientist, but you really have to try to build that model to understand how close you are, right? So one of the things we do with our robotic models, in addition to isolating parts, is we simplify the fish that we're trying to reconstruct. We have a system in which we have the tail that moves back and forth in order to push the fish through the water. And we have a very simple sensory system, an eye, and what's called a lateral line, which is the equivalent of an inside-out ear that a fish has on its body. And that can detect pressure waves in the water. And then that sensory system, the eye and the inside-out ear and the tail, are connected by this thing we call a brain. And our brain in our robotic fishes is quite simplified as well. But the whole thing, we put it all together, we have an autonomous system. That is a robot that operates on its own without anybody doing remote control. And so then we create a population of these simplified animal models that we call these fish robots. We put them in a tank together and we stand back, videotape them, let them go. And that's when we play the game of life. So we can simplify, we can reduce, and we can understand.
So I'm assuming when we're talking about simplifying these robots, you're not necessarily trying to, let's say, replicate the organism in its entirety. Is there something specific you're usually trying to test with these?
We're always after some specific hypothesis. And a hypothesis, as you know, is just a fancy way of saying our best guess as to how the system is working. So as you mentioned in the intro, you know, part of where I started out is trying to study animals by doing this thing called biomechanics, which I like to think of as sort of reverse engineering. You know, you start with a fish or a dolphin and you say, how the heck is it doing the incredible athletic things that it's doing? And so then you reach into the engineer's toolkit and you pull out from her toolkit equations and tests and things like that to try to understand how the animals are put together to allow them to do what they can do. The problem with that approach is there's only so much you can do on a system that is so complex. So let me give you an example of the way how we got to making a certain kind of simplification. As I mentioned, I'm really interested in the evolution of vertebrates, this group that's 500 million years old, these animals with backbones. And the irony is that the first vertebrates didn't have vertebrae, the bones after which they're named. So early on, these bones in the back had to evolve. So why did that happen? And from biomechanical studies, working with great colleagues and students in my laboratory, we have some ideas about the importance biomechanically of having these bones in your back. They make your backbone stiffer. You have a stiffer backbone. You can store more energy. You can swim faster. But that doesn't tell us what happened evolutionarily. What were the selective forces that drove it? So we took our biomechanical understanding and we had this best guess about what happened evolutionarily. Our guess was, hey, early on, animals that had a few vertebrae were probably faster swimmers. If they were faster swimmers than those animals who didn't have vertebrae, they could probably be better at foraging, finding food, and they could probably be better at avoiding predators. So eating and avoiding being eaten, those are pretty basic things. So that was our guess as to what was driving then the evolution of vertebrae. So that's a very specific example of what we did, and you had a question about it. You know, how do you simplify? Why do you simplify? It was to test that hypothesis about the origin of these vertebrae.
If we're talking about evolution, then I'm guessing that it's not just about building the robot, but also about, I guess, building the environment that the robot interacts in, because we're talking about evolutionary pressures that would push a creature to evolve. So do you also have to take sort of consideration of where you're putting the robots, what kind of environment they're in?
Absolutely. Thank you, Rochelle. I mean, you're exactly on, and I think a lot of people forget about that. They just think about building robots, but every robot you build behaves in some world. And so you are right. We have to build and design and model a world as well. And we build a very simplified world. Again, we build an aquatic world, and part of the world we build also has a predator in it. So we have another fish-like animal in the world that's trying to hunt down the population or the group of these robots that we're interested in evolving. So those predators apply part of the selection pressure that makes a decision about who's going to be able to breed, who gets to make new robots. And that's the essence of modeling evolution, is to come up with that process of what we talk about as differential reproduction. The fact that if evolution is to occur, you can't have everybody having the same number of offspring.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking, hosted this week by Rochelle Saunders. We're here with Dr. John Long, director of the Interdisciplinary Robotics Research Laboratory at Vassar College and author of the book Darwin's Devices, What Evolving Robots Can Teach Us About the History of Life and the Future of Technology. Okay, so before we get into your robots too much, which we will come back to, I want to define a couple of terms. You use the words agency and autonomy in your book a lot. What do those mean exactly?
If you are an agent, where this comes from is cognitive science and also artificial intelligence. It speaks to the fact that you operate independently without any outside control. And so, for example, we as humans take agency for granted when we're adults. So we're all responsible, we have free will, and so we are legally agents. We're responsible for our own behavior. If we then think about our own development, though, there's a time very early in our own development when we wouldn't want to necessarily give the same kinds of agency or ascribe the same kinds of agency to a baby, a newborn baby. So what happens in human development is we develop our motor skills, our ability to move around. We develop our sensory skills. We develop our ability to communicate. And as those skills develop in our own lifetimes, we develop this sense of agency. So agents have goals, and they make decisions about what they're going to do in the world in order to achieve those goals. So that's an agent. And one of the things that's happened in robotics in the past 30 years is that robots have gotten more and more agency, right? They make more and more of their decisions on their own. And this is closely related to the second term you want to define, which is autonomy. You hear a lot about autonomy in the news right now because we're worried about the drones, the unmanned aerial vehicles that are being used by the U.S. military and the CIA to conduct both overt and covert operations overseas. And right now, all the unmanned aerial vehicles that are in operation have a human in the loop, meaning there's somebody sitting there watching a video screen and making the decision about, do I fire? Does the machine fire a weapon or not? Or does the machine turn and go away? Is it just a surveillance trip? Now, what is the machine itself doing? Well, it's got partial autonomy, meaning partial independence, partial independent operation. And that is, the machines themselves control a lot of the little things that a pilot would do if the pilot were flying it, keeping it at altitude, using onboard sensors to nail down a navigational direction and fly in that direction. And the human has taken over the autonomy of actually deciding if this vehicle is going to be used as a weapon or not. So we talk about levels of autonomy and types of autonomy. So there's a behavioral autonomy that we think about. I don't know if you have a Roomba or not. Do you have a Roomba?
I sure do.
You do?
I do.
That's awesome.
I love my Roomba.
Your Roomba's got a kind of autonomy to it, right? You turn it on and you don't have to tell it what to do. It's behaviorally autonomous. It operates on its own. It's taking in sensory input and making decisions based on that. So it's got both agency and autonomy. They're really the same side of the coin, if you will. But your Roomba doesn't have the kind of autonomy of, gee, I'm going to go shopping today, right? So autonomy is limited and really described or describable to very specific kinds of situations. Back to your point about worlds. Robots are always designed with certain tasks in mind. And it's that world of tasking where we judge the autonomy. So your Roomba's actually got, for its job, its task, which is to keep your floors clean, it's got a heck of a lot of autonomy. So that's just an example for you, a couple examples.
Let's get into actual evolving robots. Now, I'm assuming when we're talking about robots evolving that we're not actually talking about robots mating in most contexts. There's no like robot nookie happening anywhere, is there?
No. And it's a good thing too, right? Or I think I would not get the funding that I get from the National Science Foundation. Thank you very much, NSF. Yeah, I don't think taxpayers who fund the NSF would tolerate the robot nookie.
I'm sure are a few who would.
You know, the Japanese are probably further along that way with their robots than the folks in the U.S. are. I encourage you and any of your listeners who are interested to look up Japanese robots there. Have some very lifelike robots. But that's not what I work on. The evolution that takes place. Well, first of all, let's talk about what do we mean by evolution. I like to think of it as the game of life. You know, what you have to do on a minute-by-minute basis to survive, to, as you say, mating is part of it, and to mate. And so we do all the survival stuff in our laboratory with our physically embodied robots. And I mentioned having a predator present. So the predator and the prey robot are having a contest in front of us, right? And in order for the world to evolve that we're watching, we need a couple of things. First of all, I hate to tell you, Rochelle, I don't know how you feel about like the self-help movement and so forth, but no individual can evolve.
I did know that. And I also did suspect it.
Yeah. We really can develop and we can learn. But what evolves is a population, that is a group of organisms that are in one at one time and in one place interacting and breeding, potentially breeding. What happens is that population is what evolves over generational time. So no individual evolves. But what happens is natural selection acts on individuals. Natural selection is, and as Darwin liked to say, is the invisible hand that is sort of minute by minute and hour by hour scrutinizing the behavior of organisms and making judgments, right, about who gets what. And so some classic examples, if you've ever heard of like Darwin's finches, we can correlate very precisely the size of the beak of those finches to the different kinds of seeds that those beaks can crush. And in very dry years in the Galapagos Islands, you really need a big beak that's very powerful to crush the seeds that haven't been dried out, and these are big, tough seeds. In wet years, it's better to have a smaller bill. So what we see in the Galapagos is as the world changes, back to your point about the importance of modeling the world, as the world changes, so do the selection pressures on those individuals. And so those individuals then either breed or don't breed. And those that breed, there are some that breed and make a lot of children and some that breed that don't make a lot of children. So that's how we set up, that's the relationship between selection, which acts on individuals, and evolution, which is something that takes place from generation to generation.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking with Rochelle Saunders, and we'll be back with more robots and evolution after this message.
Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Rochelle Saunders. I'm here with Dr. John Long, professor of biology and cognitive science, and director of the Interdisciplinary Robotics Research Laboratory at Vassar College. We're talking about robots that evolve and what they can tell us about creatures long extinct. Okay, so let's maybe talk about one of your projects specifically. The Tadros robot was an evolving robot, I think one of the first ones that you built and tested. Walk me through that experiment, sort of what happened.
Okay, so what we have in our laboratory is we actually make a population of these Tadros. We have 6 Tadro individuals in a generation, and let me tell you about them. So natural selection, in order to work, there has to be differences among individuals. Otherwise, it's like like walking into a restaurant and there's only one thing on the menu, right? So natural selection is all about choosing different items on the menu. So we start out our population of tadros by randomly creating individuals with different numbers of vertebrae, different abilities to detect a predator using their lateral line acoustic system, and different size tails. And so we just start this out randomly to give us some different items on the menu. So we'll take one of these robots and we'll put it into a big tank that we have in our lab. It's a 10-foot diameter black tank. The whole lab is black because we have to control the lighting. We call it the abyss because the abyss is the part of the ocean where no light goes in. It's a really kind of a dreary place to work because it's so dark. But we play The Cure, you know, and we kind of get into the whole goth scene as we're doing it, right?
That's awesome.
We're in this dark lab and we put one of these tadros in the tank and we turn on a light. Now, what the tadro is designed to do, because it's an autonomous agent, is it's designed to seek out light. And in life, light is life, okay? Because that's where photosynthesis happens. Plants make glucose and animals eat plants. So the robot goes after the light. What it doesn't know is there's a predator in the tank. This predator is single-minded and it wants to get that prey item. So it wants to eat the prey while the prey is trying to get to the light to eat. And so we have a video camera overhead. We put the prey robot in the tank, turn it on, and we stand back and we just videotape it for 3 minutes. And we watch them race around the tank. And these aren't incredibly fast, but they move around the tank. They interact. We don't have jaws or like buzz saws or anything like that on the predator. What happens is the predator will come up and just sort of pound on the prey item. And what we're doing afterwards is we take that videotape and we go back through and we score it, almost like an Olympic event. We go back and we look at all the moves and we give each individual points, each individual prey, we give them points for moving quick, for accelerating rapidly when they detect the predator, for being able to detect the predator in the first place, for when they find the food, being able to stay there right where the food is. So there's a trade-off immediately, because if you stay where the food is, that may keep you fed, but you're just a sitting duck for the predator. So just like in real life, there are all these trade-offs. So now that's just one individual, Rochelle. And then what we do is we do the same trial with the other five individuals in the population. And then we do it with three more times for each one of these individuals. And then we remake each one of these individuals two more times. And so we essentially clone them and do all the experiments again. So we have lots of repetition in our experiment. So we feel like the results are really robust. And then that's the end of the experiment for that generation in the laboratory. And that's when we have to go to the computer. And finally, we get to the robot Nookie, and the individuals that have the highest score in the evolutionary Olympics there in the tank, they're the ones that on the computer get to have the most offspring. And here's where the computer simulation comes in. So what we do is we make egg and sperm in simulation on the computer. We mutate them and we then recombine them in a totally random mating algorithm.
That has, I guess, some influence based on how many children each tadros can have?
You got it. We have, for this population of six individuals, we take the top three. So you can think of them as gold, silver, and bronze winners. Mm-hmm. The top gold winner gets to make in the next generation three individuals. The silver winner gets to make two individuals, and the bronze winner gets to make one. And this is, it's not like they clone themselves. What happens is we toss their computer-generated egg and sperm into what I like to call, Anna, forgive me, Nobody likes what I'm about to say. I like to think of it as a mating bucket. The sperm and egg go into, like, you think of it mathematically as the equivalent of a cocktail shaker. Egg and sperm go in there and we shake up the egg and sperm and they randomly mate. And we pull out of the cocktail mix, then out of our mating bucket, we pull out the instructions for the six new individuals to make in the next generation.
I love evolving robots. My cool. Technician and I are cracking up pretty loud in here.
You like the mating bucket, huh?
Okay, I do. Cool. We do like the mating bucket. It gets big thumbs up. So my understanding, based on reading your book, is that it sounds like primarily what you were evolving with the Tadros experiment was the vertebrate tail tail?
We do different kinds of experiments, but the tail is definitely of an interest to me because that backbone that we have is so important in who we are as vertebrates, right? And humans are one kind of land vertebrate. But, you know, every vertebrate out there has some kind of crazy backbone thing happening. For us, we worry about back problems because we're bipeds and we're not used to evolutionarily being on our feet, which isn't really true, but we do worry about getting back problems. So we have to think about, you know, what's the evolutionary history, the baggage that we bring with us from having been a fish. So if we understand evolution of fish 500 million years ago, we understand something about humans. So that's one character that we're interested in. Another character is, I mentioned this idea of evolving the predator detection, the ability to do that. And so that lateral line thing that I mentioned, you know, this is when you go into an aquarium store and there's a little sign on the fish tank and it says, don't tap the glass, right? And this is like the forbidden fruit. And it's like, of course I'm going to tap the glass because you told me not to do it. And you tap the glass and the fish that's in there, it's as though, sorry, I'm going to go all Star Trek on you. It's as though it's been beamed up to the Enterprise and beamed down elsewhere in the tank. It's moved so quickly. It's accelerated sometimes at 10 times the acceleration rate of gravity, 10 G these fish can move. And it's gone poof over to the other side of the tank in a blink of an eye. And so this ability to detect a prey, right? You're a prey and you're tapping on the glass, just like a fish coming up, another fish, a bigger fish, would be doing the equivalent of tapping on the glass by pushing a big bolus of water in front of it. This is an evolutionary conserved character trait, really important. And it's very important in neurobiology because this is an ability, this connection between this inside out ear, the lateral line, and a motor response is something that we even retain. So for example, if right now, don't worry, I'm not going to do this to you. If I were to take one of those like ship horns and just like not tell you, but go into the microphone, you would jump, or most of us would jump. So we all still have an escape response, a reaction that's built into loud noises, right? Loud noises are informative. So this is another character that we can evolve too, as well as the size of the tail. And what's really cool when we evolve multiple characters is we can look at how they interact, right? Because here's the problem with the modeling that we set up. Yeah, it's great to simplify stuff and great to look at just one thing at a time. But then you say, you know what? But that's, you know, the vertebrate body didn't just evolve backbones and then say, okay, now we're going to evolve the head and now we're going to evolve the jaws. All those things were evolving or not evolving in concert. So once you understand the simplest model, the next trick is to put some spices back in that include some more complexity. And the spices that we've put back in on top of the backbone are these sensory systems.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking with Rochelle Saunders. Okay, so you actually ran an original version, I believe the Tadros 3 experiment, and do correct me if I'm wrong there, testing a simpler version of the Tadros.
Yep.
And what happened when you actually sat down and crunched the data?
That was very simple. We were just looking at the tail, and we wanted to know if we applied a selection pressure. Our idea, our hypothesis that we were testing was that, look, selection for getting food, right? That's got to be there for any organism. And so let's see if that selection pressure alone is sufficient to drive the evolution of vertebrae. Our hypothesis was that it was. And we ran 10 generations, which doesn't sound like many, but we have to build these robots every generation. We have to do all these trials that we do. We have to analyze all the videotapes. So that took us, those 10 generations took, there were about five of us working for about 10 weeks to do those 10 generations. So we could do about a generation a week there. And so we got done with the 10 generations and we looked at the evolutionary patterns, expecting to see the backbone get stiffer over time. And we had just the opposite pattern. And this is why you run the models, you know, you do the tests, because even though you may think that you're right and you know the system, you don't know until you actually do the experiments.
What turned out, was your hypothesis wrong or was it an error in something you had built? I'm curious sort of what happened there.
We work very carefully to do what's called falsification, which is to set up hypotheses, not to try to prove them, but to try to prove them wrong, to falsify them. And the reason this is important, and sorry, this is a little bit of scientific philosophy here, is that when people say they prove something, they mean that they've demonstrated that it has happened. And the problem with that stance is that you may have a system behave in a certain way and you say, aha, you know, here, look, these Tadros, they have stiffer tails, they get more food, therefore that proves that evolution happened that way. And so if you go down a road like that, what you don't pay attention to are other factors that you may have ignored that may be the causal agents, the things causing that behavior. behavior. So if you're careful to falsify, to try to prove yourself wrong, I know you'll appreciate this on the show, that's really being a skeptical scientist, right? Is you always think that your ideas are wrong and you set out to prove them wrong. And it's only when you can't prove them wrong after repeated attempts to do so that you say, you know what? This looks like a fact, or this looks like something close to the truth, as opposed to what we tend to do when we're out to prove ourselves right, is we select the data that proves ourselves right. That's called confirmation bias. We're all very susceptible to it. Every politician does this. You know, you pick the data, you cherry pick the data to prove your own argument. And unfortunately, some scientists can get into this as well. So to your point, so we proved our hypothesis wrong and we were happy that we had. It wasn't a problem with the tests. It was a good experiment. And what we say is, you know what? We don't think the selection pressure for feeding alone, for enhanced feeding performance, was sufficient to have driven the early evolution of vertebrates. So by negating that hypothesis, we learned something cool, right? Which is, hey, we don't know what we're talking about yet. So we got to find the next idea to test.
There is a great line in your book that I would like to have emblazoned on my wall above my desk, which is, in science, this kind of failure is called progress. I really liked that one.
Well, I'm glad you did, because man, my students get really bummed out when, you know, first day they come into the lab and we're, you know, getting ready to this idea of falsification and stuff. And I say, look, you know, I want you guys to get used to the idea that we're trying to fail here, right? I mean, that's the whole game. And we're trying to falsify the hypotheses, which is a kind of failure. And also, when we sit down to actually design or build a robot, you know what? It's not going to work most of the time. It's going to fail. And that failure is, in that sense, as well, progress. Because as my undergraduate advisor said, a guy named Butch Rommel said to me many years ago, he said, if you're not failing, you're not trying hard enough. So it's something that works in a strictly scientific sense, as you're bringing up, but also works in a creative sense as well. You know, when you think about people like Edison, you know, designing the light bulb, and what did he try? 100 or 300 or 2,000 different kinds of filaments before he got the one that worked. And that's the perspiration part of what he talked about with innovation as well. So yeah, we're walking around failing and failing on purpose.
After the Tadros 3, progress is what I'm going to call it, you turned around and did the Tadros 4 experiment, where you made some really significant changes to both the robot and your process. This is also where you added a predator into the tank, correct?
In that first trial with the TADRO 3s, where we were just looking at feeding, we didn't have the predator present. And so, again, this is the careful complication or complexification, to create a bad word, that we wanted to do, thinking, okay, look, just feeding alone isn't sufficient. So what if you had to feed? Because everybody still has to feed. So we don't want to take that away. But what would you add to that? Well, a logical thing is that selection pressure for predation. And what we know, here's where this wonderful handshaking comes along with living fishes and studies on living creatures. We know from living fishes out in the wild that if you put, for example, a predator into a lake, it changes. It evolves the population of prey fish in that lake very rapidly. And so we know that predator selection is a really strong evolutionary force in the wild. And so this seemed to us to be a good reason to try that next. There's also been a lot of hypothesizing that the 500 million years ago, when this explosion in body forms happened that we call the Cambrian explosion, there's been hypothesizing that that was actually caused by the evolution of predation itself. So given that we were down in the same area near the Cambrian explosion, we thought, you know what, this is a good place to try predation as well. So we coupled that with feeding and made the evolutionary process thereby more complex.
So what was the result of the Tadros 4 experiment?
Yeah, well, so if I weren't being careful, and let me just not be careful for a second, what I would tell you is we proved our hypothesis that selection pressure for enhanced feeding and predator avoidance was sufficient to evolve vertebrae. But I won't do that. Let me be careful, okay?
Okay?
So the careful way to phrase that is we were trying to falsify the hypothesis that selection for enhanced feeding, enhanced predator avoidance was the cause of the evolution of vertebrae. And we were unable to refute that hypothesis. So that's the careful way of saying it, okay? And by virtue of being unable to refute that hypothesis or to disprove it, what we say is we have tentative support that this may be at least probable or possible cause for the evolution of vertebrae. So we try to be very cautious about that. Leave open the idea that we should try different experiments. Leave open the idea also, in the case of fossils, that we can never hop in the TARDIS and go back and look at what was actually happening 500 million years ago. I'm sorry, Emma. My daughters have me into Doctor Who right now. And so the TARDIS, in case you don't know, is Doctor Who's time machine, right? So we can't go back and see what happened 500 million years ago. So we'll never know for sure, right? So the best we can say is this is a possible cause of the evolution that happened 500 million years ago.
So is there a Tadros 5 in the works?
Well, you know, we're doing a couple of, I would say, sort of daughter of or son of Tadro experiments right now. One of them is we're actually looking at the ability to create a behavior that's called, well, everybody knows, so it's not like it's anything special I have to reveal. Schooling, right? Fish school, and how do they do it? So birds flock, fish school. You can actually watch human pedestrians or human car drivers. They'll do various kinds of what some people call swarm intelligence, different kinds of swarm intelligence. And so we've taken our Tadros and we said, you know what? Everybody's assuming for swarm intelligence that you have to be able to communicate with other individuals in your swarm. And that communication can be just verbal, right? It can be the kind of thing of, well, you know what? I can see you and I know you're part of my swarm, so I'm going to approach you, but not too close. And so approaching but avoiding is a really important part of the computer science behind creating the flocking algorithms that are used in things like the Lord of the Rings trilogy, when they have all the orcs, you know, and they're coming up to Minas Tirith and they're all together. Those are all computer animated using some of these flocking algorithms. And so we said, you know what? Let's get rid of the ability of our Tadros to be able to sense each other. And all they can do is go to the light. And so what happens when we put 10 Tadros in the tank, no predator here, just the 10 Tadros who are all hungry and they can't detect each other, what do? And they all swim towards the light. They bounce around, right? They hit each other. And then after a while, those collisions are sufficient to realign the Tadros so that after about 2 minutes, what happens is the Tadros are going in a conga line around the light source. Can I say damn on the radio?
Yes, go for it.
It's the damnedest thing. When these Tadros go to the light source, they have all these collisions and the next thing you know, they're doing this conga line. It's just so cool. And so what we know then, based on what the Tadros are telling us here in this behavioral experiment, is that you don't need to be able to sense your other individuals. You just need to be at the same place in time and share a goal. And it's the goal sharing that we think is important here for this swarming event, because the goal brings all the individuals together such that they interact ballistically with collisions and things like that. And it's those collisions over time establish what we think of physically as an energy equilibrium state that's very stable and doesn't involve many collisions. So that's one of the experiments that's been a follow-up from using these autonomous behaving robots, the Tadros.
I do want to talk a little bit about one of the ideas you put forth in your book that I had never considered before. We spend a lot of time talking about the brain and waxing on about the mysteries of the brain, and you put forward that the brain isn't actually very useful to us or to anybody without a body attached to it, which I had never thought of before.
We are such a neurocentric species, right? And there's so many interesting things. And let me just skip quickly to the fact that, you know, we humans, we always want to be number one, right? It's like, we rule the planet. Look, we got language. We got all this technology. It must be because of our great brain, right? Because we look at other animals and we're like, well, what do we got that nobody else has? Well, we have this relative to our body size. We have this giant brain. We know the brain's important for intelligence. Boom, this must be the answer. But what people neglect is one of the things that humans have is we have amazing manual dexterity, right? So we have 10 digits in our two hands that have amazing fine motor control. You know, we make jokes about, you know, who's got an opposable thumb in the animal kingdom and stuff like that. Well, an opposable thumb's really important, but so is each finger having 1, 2, 3 joints that can bend, each finger under independent control. And guess what? We have a lot of our cortex in our brain. There are actually more motor connections than there are other connections in our brain. So our brain is actually wired to take care of this amazing body we have to manipulate the world through the movement, right? So if you think about this amazing ability we have to move, well, how does that play into our idea of intelligence? Well, of course, we have to make things. Even our tongue which I don't know if you, there's this old TV show called Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Did you ever watch that?
I'm a huge fan of Buffy. I'm a big Buffy nerd.
Okay, so there's the Angel spinoff, right? And there's this one episode of Angel where he finds himself in a pit with a demon who's ripping out the talking meat of the humans that he's got in there. And the talking meat is the tongue. And I love that because it reminds us that this tongue, this thing that allows us in part to have language, is this incredibly delicate, finely innervated piece of muscle that we have in our mouths, right? That allows us to do this articulation that we're doing right now. So again, that's a piece of our body, right? That has to be co-evolved with our brain in order to give the intelligence that we recognize as language, right? So there are all these cases where you can just say, you know what? The brain never exists without a body. There's no such thing as a brain operating in a vat. And in fact, I've talked to some neuroscientists, some neurosurgeons actually, who say, you know what? If you were to cut all the nerves, all the sensory nerves that you had, you would be unconscious. That the fact that we have this experience of consciousness is because we have information coming in and we have motor reactions coming out that allow us to integrate seamlessly or have the experience of integrating seamlessly with a world in which we're constantly moving. And so that coupling of movement, which happens with the body, is one way to argue it, is the essence of what we call cognition or thinking.
It's interesting because even without a brain, because these robots are autonomous and interacting with the world and sort of making, I guess, decisions based on the feedback they're getting from the environment, they are kind of in a way intelligent.
Thank you. There are not many people, not many humans with big brains who are willing to admit that you can have a very simple robot and have it exhibit what we would call intelligence. But I think it is intelligent, right, to be able to find a light source or to be able to evade a predator. And so, right, we talk about these robots as pieces of embodied intelligence. And it's how we get to talk about things like intelligent machines in general. And in many ways, we are living the robot revolution now, and it's not Skynet, okay? You know, the robots aren't taking over. We are interacting with the robots. The robots live with us, your Roomba, for example. The intelligence you may have in the Mercedes that you drive. I don't have a Mercedes, so I don't have intelligence in my car. But, you know, the distraction sensors that go on, or the ability to apply the brake when you're using your cruise control. These are bits of intelligence that we're putting into the machines with which we interact all the time. So it's really cool. There's intelligence all around us, and you seem to be able to see that. So you will have, I think, a richer experience in the robot revolution than other people who just say, oh, it's just a machine. It's not really intelligent. I don't care as long as it gets the job done and doesn't hurt me.
I want to be on the side of the robots because I think if there's a side, they'll probably be the winners. John, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, you're welcome.
If you want to learn more about the Robotics Research Laboratory or Dr. Long's research, you can visit his website at pages.vassar.edu/Darwin's Devices, a link that will be available in our show notes. You can find those show notes on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, guest host Rochelle Saunders explores the ways that math can help and hinder the pursuit of justice. Rochelle speaks to mathematician Layla Schnapps, co-author of the book Math on Trial, How Numbers Get Used and Abused in the Courtroom. And she's joined by Patrick Ball to talk about his work as executive director of the Human Rights Data Analysis Group. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
So now that we've heard how autonomous robots are helping shed light on evolution in our distant past, let's find out how robots are being used to push us into the future. One of NASA's centennial challenges is the Sample Return Robot Challenge, designed to spur innovation in autonomous robot design. I'm joined by Stephen Waslander, assistant professor in the Department of Mechanical and Mechatronics Engineering at the University of Waterloo, and the director of the Waterloo Autonomous Vehicles Laboratory in Ontario, Canada. He is the academic advisor to the University of Waterloo robotics team, which recently competed in the 2013 NASA Sample Return Robot Challenge. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, tell us about NASA's Sample Return Robot Challenge. What is it?
Basically, it's a 2-hour challenge where you're supposed to cover about 8 football fields worth of park area, so trees and grass, and look for about 10 different samples and collect them all completely autonomously with a robot that has no connection to a human operator.
I'm getting visions of like a robot scavenger hunt.
Absolutely right. That's a great example. Each of the robots does it individually, and so you get your own 2-hour slot on the course, and you have to find all these samples, collect them with some sort of mechanism, and then bring them back to a home base, just as you would on, say, a Mars sample return mission.
So give us a little bit of history on this challenge. When was it issued?
It's actually only been around for 2 years. It was issued probably 2011. The first competition was last year, and then this is the second event we just went to this year.
So did you guys compete last year as well?
We did, yeah. We were there the first time around and did much better the second time.
Awesome. So do you get the full year to prepare, I guess?
Yeah, you can spend as much time, include as many people as you want. There's basically no limitations on how your team prepares itself.
I know that your team at the University of Waterloo is actually quite large.
Because we're a university, we have a lot of students that are interested in doing extracurricular projects, partially to just boost experience, increase their opportunities in terms of what employers are looking for. And so we bring a lot of these students on board, and they contribute in both small and large ways to the overall completion of the project.
Where are these students coming from? Are they mostly engineers? Are they mostly computer science guys? What's going on there?
They're almost entirely engineers. We do have a finance student, but it turns out that he's a really good machinist and does that on the side as well. But for the most part, it's engineering students, graduate students and undergrads from mechanical, from electrical, from computer engineering, and even system design.
Now, I understand that even though your team entered the challenge, you weren't actually even eligible for the prize.
Right. We're Canadians, and so we don't officially qualify for the NASA prize money. But this year, they did expand the prizes so that there were some prizes for all participants, including those from other countries. And so the Canadians, ourselves, and a team from Estonia both won some prize money this year, which was great.
The things we do for love.
Yes, yes, exactly. So yeah, there's this giant ticket, this $1.5 million prize that's out there. And certainly it draws some strong teams from the U.S. But we were just there because of the excitement of the challenge and the actual difficulty of completing the task.
So obviously the prize money here will draw a lot of interest from the U.S. because those are the people that are eligible. But how many sort of international teams were there involved in the competition this year?
Yeah, only 2. So out of the 12 teams, there were 10 U.S. teams, and the 2 of us, Estonia and the Canadians. Yeah.
Let's talk about what everyone really wants to hear, which is robots. What in sort of the terms of this competition does autonomous robot mean? I know that it sounds like they had to navigate the course themselves, but did they actually have to find the item, or could you like point it in the right direction?
No, absolutely. There's no involvement of humans at all. So we broke the task down into basically 3 main functions. The first one was mapping. We had to maintain knowledge of where the robot was, what it has seen, and where the base station was so that at the end of the competition, it could return to base. Then we had to plan a route. So the second main chunk was planning. And this is where we had to decide which areas we wanted to go to next and explore and look for samples. And then the last main task was detection. And so here we used 3 cameras arrayed in sort of a 180-degree field of view, looking for individual samples at all times as we're driving through the environment.
It sounds like the robot didn't know where it was looking for the items, but did it know
Absolutely.
What items it was looking for?
Yeah, so they do give us that advantage. So we pre-train our classifiers and our sample identifier algorithms on hockey pucks, pink tennis balls, orange batons, that sort of object. So they're all less than 20 centimeters long and fairly visible relative to a green grassy background.
So they gave you, I guess, a list of items you might potentially have to search for before the competition?
That's right. Yep. And so we had samples of the actual, we had the actual samples ahead of time. We had images of what the samples would look like on the grass. And so we were able to basically tailor our algorithms to the specifics of the challenge itself.
And what about the terrain? Did you get even like any kind of map of what the terrain might be?
We have a rough topographical map of the environment. So you have basically contours and altitude, and you have knowledge of where any bodies of water are. But other than that, you have not a lot of information. You have a few features in the environment like posts, and the rest is basically up to you or up to your robot to discover and understand.
And no GPS, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And that's the biggest part of this challenge that makes it interesting. No GPS and no magnetometer. And so you really don't have the standard navigation tools that you would use on Earth, which makes it much more of a Mars analog. And it means that you have to rely on sensors that are measuring what's around you and only use that relative information to the environment that's right next to you to discover whether or not you've been to an area before and how that area matches up with the areas you've already explored.
So let's talk about the University of Waterloo's robot. How did your robot navigate?
So ours uses a Velodyne laser scanner right at the top of the robot. And this is the same laser scanner that's on top of the Google car. And a lot of people have seen that recently. And so what it does is it shoots out 32 laser beams in basically a donut pattern all the way around the robot. And that updates at 10 times a second. So we have a very nice picture out to about 100 meters of our immediate surroundings. And what we do is we aggregate that information as we drive along, and we match each one of these laser scans, each one of these donuts of points that we've collected, to previous scans that we've seen in the environment earlier. And so what that allows us to do is basically uncover how far we've moved and in what direction we've moved, and then aggregate the information and build this map as we move along through the environment.
You mentioned planning before. I'm assuming this means sort of planning a route?
Exactly right, yeah. So you can imagine this environment had a lot of trees, it had some buildings, it had benches, it had ditches, it had rocks, it had water. And so there were a lot of areas that we simply couldn't pass through as a robot. So it wasn't a matter of, you know, sweeping the way the Roomba sweeps through your living room, right? It really had to miss all kinds of large structures. And it would be inefficient to simply be bouncing around and hoping that we would eventually cover the area. Because of the tight time limit, we had to make sure that we were navigating efficiently and covering as much of the unknown environment as quickly as possible.
How do you even begin to navigate an environment like that efficiently with a robot?
So this is the next part that we really got excited about. I had two grad students working on this, and what we did was we would decompose the map as we were building. And so we would identify regions that we had fully uncovered with our laser scanner, and we would sweep those very carefully with our cameras in order to determine whether or not there were any samples in those areas. And as we swept those known regions, we would see more of the unknown areas that were on the outside or out of the boundaries of our laser scanner sensor. And we could then expand our path and expand and find new regions to explore afterwards. And so what we had essentially was this evolving path that would lock down and eliminate large regions as they became visible, and then move to the next one only when it had completed the area that it was already certain about.
How close did your robot have to be before it recognized the item it was looking for?
So we had maximum field of view of about 3 meters from our cameras. So anything outside of 3 meters on either side of the robot, so basically a 6 meter swath, was a bit too far for us to see. And really this came down to the angle at which we could see the objects lying on the ground. Outside of 3 meters, it was possible for the objects actually to be occluded by the grass. And so it was unreliable to detect outside of that range. So all of these paths that we were navigating, we had to basically sweep with a 6 meter pattern. So we would be literally going back and forth, you know, 6 meters at a time over each one of these areas.
And how wide did you say this course was?
Maximum of 80,000 square meters, or 8 football fields in length. So our calculations were that it would have taken us at top speed, which was 2 meters per second, about 95 minutes to actually cover every possible region in the environment if it was the full 80,000 meters of area, right? As it turned out, it was actually far less than that, simply because there were significant areas that were occluded with obstacles. And
so
we ended up having sufficient time.
So they didn't do something horrible like hide the prize over on the other side of the river.
Yeah, exactly right. And I should make one thing clear. We've been talking a lot about the whole challenge, the level 2 challenge, and our robot was fully capable of doing the level 2 challenge. But at the competition itself, we were only actually doing the level 1 challenge, which was to identify a single object, scan a single area of about 50 meters for it, and then return to base all within half an hour.
Sorry, was the first challenge. And then I guess if you passed the first challenge, you got to go on to the second one?
You move on to level 2. Exactly right. Yep.
Oh, so where was the challenge for you guys? What tripped you up for level 1?
So level 1, basically we were able to complete everything in level 1 with one exception. We had to collect the initial sample, which had a large hook on it, and that large hook actually got stuck on our collection mechanism instead of safely being stored inside this at the center of the robot. robot. So after we completed our scan and had identified that object and picked it up, when we returned to base, that object was still dangling off the front of our collection mechanism at the front of our robot. And so when we parked ourselves beautifully right on the spot we were supposed to park ourselves, the sample itself was still dangling about 5 centimeters outside of the safe region or of the home base. And so basically we were within 5 centimeters of having qualified for level 2.
Oh no.
Yeah, it was absolutely heart-wrenching.
Oh, so, 5 centimeters.
Yeah, and so we were basically the first team that did the full demonstration of the entire level 1 sample collection and return to base, and yet we were only within a hair of actually completing the challenge. Yeah.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. We're talking about cutting-edge robotics with Stephen Waslander, academic advisor to the University of Waterloo Autonomous Vehicles Laboratory and assistant professor at the University of Waterloo. There seems like a lot of elements involved here. Navigation, planning, retrieval, stability if you're going over different kinds of terrain, search and identification, size and weight restrictions, time restrictions. What did your team find the most challenging?
Definitely it was on the integration side. Because we had 2 years to build this, the core algorithms, the 3 pieces that I described, were reasonably mature, although I'll say that the sample detection was probably the hardest aspect in terms of getting it reliable enough to work every time in the competition. But this year, we focused on basically a full redesign of the hardware of the robot and on the sample collection unit, this unit that was supposed to pick up all of the samples. And those pieces, bringing all of those together and then getting all of the algorithms on board and testing every possible situation, that was literally the last 3 months of the year, and it was an absolute rush. It was an unbelievably complex challenge, and it's exactly as you're describing. There's so many aspects, and there were so many failure modes, and there were so many small cases that had to be checked and confirmed, and so many unforeseen situations that the robot ended up in at the competition. That really was the most difficult part.
What were some of the unforeseen circumstances?
For example, the sample getting stuck on the collection mechanism. This was one that we hadn't predicted, and most of the time when we were collecting it, there was no issue at all. There were issues with the grass length complicating the detection algorithms in the right, simply because we're relying on vision data there. And so if part of the object is occluded, if you can't see it until you're basically right on top of it, then it becomes quite challenging to actually detect it. And so all these sort of things just kept cropping up, you know, these handshakes between different aspects of the algorithm. Should we return back to the home base immediately when we've detected that we've collected a single sample, or should we keep trying to collect samples until we're absolutely certain that one has been restored? These were the sort of issues that had to get solved.
So there's some strategy there as well. And that would have been for the level 2 section of, do you sort of take what you can get and sort of waste the time in lots of return trips, or you know, go and get as much as you can and hope you can make it back in time?
Exactly right.
And
yeah.
Does all of that decision making have to rest within the robot?
Absolutely. Yeah. There is no, as I've said, there is no human intervention at any point in the mission. In fact, they impound the vehicles at 8 p.m. the night before. And it's not the competitors, but it's actually the officials that boot up the robot, that press the single start button to launch all of the scripts on board and get the robot up and running. And so it's actually interesting, at the competition you'll see most of the robots simply sit there for 2 minutes at the start of the challenge, booting up all their computers and running all their test scripts. And so this is basically how hands-off it is, how autonomous these vehicles have to be.
So how similar were the different robots designed and created by the different teams? I'm not necessarily talking about looks, but in how they functioned, how they navigated, how they sort of solved these problems that an autonomous robot has to solve.
I'd say there were two main strategies. There was ours, which was essentially trying to fully understand the environment, map the environment, and keep track in great detail, basically maintain a consistent map throughout the entire process and thereby improve the efficiency of the overall collection. And there was the other class, which was essentially working on dead reckoning, which was basically looking to identify the base station from a long distance away. And so they could simply wander the environment, and at some point, as long as they could look back and see the home beacon, they would eventually be able to find their way back. So there was sort of the advanced autonomy option and the fail-safe or, you know, a decoupled strategy that a lot of teams use.
Since I believe this was the second sample robot competition, is there going to be a third?
It sounded fairly optimistic. optimistic. Yeah, each year they go through the same process with NASA, making sure that the people that hosted it can host it again, and that NASA wants to continue the challenge, and that they haven't learned all the answers to their giant challenge. Of course, since nobody won, and in fact nobody entered the level 2 competition, I'm fairly confident they'll want to run it again. And we also showed significant progress over year 1. So a lot of the same teams returned with much better designs, much more reliable robots. And so I have a very strong, it's very likely that we'll see another competition next year.
From year 1 to year 2, did you work over the same terrain and with the same objects, or did they change that up year after year as well?
No, it was basically the same setting. So both years we had knowledge ahead of time from the topographic maps of what the environment would look like. We had knowledge of where sort of the first level, the level 1 sample would be, and then that stayed consistent between 2 years.
So any future competitions coming up in your sights?
Well, we're strongly considering going back to for year 3 of the sample return challenge, essentially because we really do want to demonstrate our level 2 capabilities. So in the lab, we're going to work on demonstrating it for ourselves over the next couple of weeks. And we'll post the video and send it to all our fellow competitors, assuming that all goes well, of course. You know, if we've got that feather in our cap, then I think we'll be in good shape for next year.
Steven, thanks for talking with me today, and good luck with all your future robot challenges.
Many thanks. Yeah, great to talk to you as well.
If you want to learn more about the Waterloo Autonomous Vehicles Laboratory, you can visit their website at wavelab.uwaterloo.ca, a link that will be, of course, available in our show notes. You can find those show notes on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And while you're there, please do keep clicking and visit our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and our Google Plus page.
This is Desiree Shell, and I wanted to take a moment to tell you about 60 Second Science, a fantastic international video contest that celebrates the human ability to understand the world around us. You can create and submit a short video explaining an invention, an experiment, a science concept, or idea. And not only will you get to show off your creativity and help the world around you understand science a little better, you'll also be in the running for a share of $10,000 in prizes. And yours truly just might be one of the judges reviewing your video. There are contest tracks for elementary, junior high, and high school students, as well as adults from amateurs to professionals. You have until November 14th to register, so if you're a creative type who loves science, visit 60secondscience.net. That's 60science.net. To get more information, find them on Facebook and Twitter, and to register to compete. And that's it for us. See you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced and distributed by Suburban Panic Media. Our guest coordinators are Rochelle Saunders and Ed Haynes. Our social media manager is Chelsea Butler. Helen Quivillon is our publications coordinator. Ryan Bromsgrove is our production manager and assistant editor. Josh Witten is our researcher. The show is edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by AOK. And I'm your host, Desiree Shell.